For The Wooden Company, this is Salvaged and Found, a woodworking and sustainability podcast where I sit down with industry leaders and owners making a difference.
I'm Alec Bayless, founder of The Wooden Company. On this episode, I hop on the phone with Bill from Lost Timber Woodwork, a fine woodworker from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Bill tells me about how he learned everything he knows about woodworking from YouTube, what makes Michigan wood special, and the importance of a shop dog. You can find his work at Etsy.com, just search Lost Timber Woodwork. We'll talk to Bill in a minute, but first, a word from our sponsor.
What was your first introduction to woodworking?
I guess my first introduction to woodworking that I like is a tangible memory was my grandpa was a woodworker. He made grandpa stuff. He made like birdhouses and, you know, mailboxes. And he had this great shop in the backyard. Had a, you know, like a wood stove in there, and he always smelled like sawdust. And he actually helped me build first thing I ever made that I like, I'm taking credit for partially when I was like, whatever, 10, was a Pinewood Derby car for the Boy Scouts.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. And, you know, you had to like follow this kind of form, and like, there was all these rules or whatever, but we, you know, we painted the American flag on that sucker. I got second place my first time.
So start with your grandpa. Then did your dad do?
No, not at all.
I mean,
this was like other side of the family, you know, this grandpa I'm talking about, he died when I was like, I don't know, 10 or 12 or something like that. But, you know, and then I wasn't like around it really a ton. It was just like when you went up to grandpa's house, which is like 3 hours away, and it wasn't like a daily thing either. It's just like a memory I have, you know, like,
yeah.
And I thought about like, oh, I wonder if that's kind of part of the reason why I'm drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
But then like I really didn't do anything until years later. I'm in my mid-20s or so. This is maybe 5 years ago, and a friend of mine had a dog, and we wanted to make a raised dog bowl feeder for his dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were just like, yeah, how are it gonna be, you know? And so looking back at it now, he still has it. Looking back at it now, it's like, oh man, that is very, very sketchy. But you know, whatever, you just figure it out and it's fine and it works. And so we made that one, and then another friend of mine wanted one, so I made one. And then I didn't like have any tools or anything, right? I was just like hacking it together with like a couple of like a hammer and like whatever else, right, I happened to have in like the apartment toolbox, you know.
Yeah.
So then I just kind of started thinking, okay, well, if I, you know, and then I just started YouTubing like everything under the sun. And I thought, okay, well, if I buy this one more tool, I'll be able to do this better, or this one part easier or faster or cleaner or whatever. And then you get that one tool and you start thinking like, oh, okay, how do I use, you know, YouTube something, and how do I do it? And then you see somebody has this other tool, and you're like, oh, okay, if I buy that one, then I'll, you know, and before too long, you start accumulating tools and being able to like learn how to do stuff. But straight up, like every skill that I have is born out of watching crap tons of YouTube videos and just like figuring it out as I go.
That is so crazy, man. That's becoming a more common story for people.
Yeah.
Like the ability to do that. And like, there's more videos every day. So it's like,
yeah. And I mean, there are a lot of really great like educators out there whose whole thing, their whole platform, I think they build things and sell things, whatever, but it's pretty clear that the reason for their platform is education,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not just to sell stuff. It's mostly like, you know, whether they get money from sponsorships or straight from YouTube, you know?
Right.
I mean, there's a specific guy, Matt Cremona, who I'm sure you've heard of, but he has a crazy YouTube channel and social media platform, and his videos are he does like, you know, three camera angles, and he edits everything down, and they're very concise but very informative, and he's hilarious, you know, they're not annoying.
Right.
It doesn't take you like watching a 45-minute video of somebody talking about nothing to get to the point, you know.
Right.
So anyway, Matt Cremona is awesome. I mean, he was a big reason that I started figuring out like some of my bigger, like, he's the reason I got a chainsaw mill,
uh-huh,
and learned how to do that, and then was able to make my own lumber and stuff like that. He just really simplified things in kind of a fun way. So, yeah, man. I mean, without YouTube, straight up, can't say that I wouldn't be here, but I definitely would not be half as far along as I am.
How do you make that jump? Like, when do you go from like, all right, I have a ton of tools in my apartment, I need to go get a studio and get space and get the chainsaw mill
right
out and all that stuff?
So at the time I was working a full-time job, and this was in a basement of a house that I was renting.
Mm-hmm.
And it was crazy. Like, talk about a fire hazard. Looking back at it now, it's like, what the hell? Like, so there was a giant furnace in the basement. It wasn't a big basement. It was like, I don't know, 15 feet by 10 feet. It was a Michigan basement, like stone walls.
Right.
And I had piles of lumber down there. I was doing epoxy pours with a propane torch burning off the bubbles.
Oh my God.
Right next to a natural gas furnace. Like,
Jesus.
There's sawdust everywhere, you know?
Right.
Probably a really bad idea. Anyway, but so I was kind of working a job at that point that I just wasn't loving that much, and ended up moving to Grand Rapids to start another business. And at that time, realized that as I was moving out of that basement, all these piles of wood and tools, that I didn't really, I mean, that was a good time to kind of scale up. So I looked around a little bit and found another woodworker who has a big warehouse, and I am currently still at this space, but I'm, you know, it's like a 650 square foot area, which is like, you know, not crazy. It's about the size of like a two-car garage.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, a considerable step up from where I was. And at this point, I am looking to buy my own like pole barn or warehouse, because I need to like triple my space. I'm just tripping over stuff, and there's projects I can't do because I'm just out of room.
Right.
So, you know, other things were happening in life, you know, moves or jobs or whatever that kind of coincided.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the main motivators for me to increase my shop size or to get a real shop and not just have it in my, you know, dank basement were starting to get custom requests or commissions for projects that I literally can't do unless I can spread out a little bit. And so that kind of starts the wheels turning, and then you start looking, you know. But I think I'm a big believer in starting scrappy and small and figuring it out, and just working your place to the gills to where, you know, I think if you do the opposite and you start off and you rent like a, you know, or buy a, you know, 2,000-3,000 square foot barn or space, and then you think, okay, now what? I see a lot of woodworkers do that, or makers in general, and they can't make it because their overhead is crazy.
Right, right.
And now you're trying to meet all your overhead needs plus try to create a brand and social media platform maybe, and create products and try to get customers. Like, it's nuts. So I'm a really big believer in starting small and being uncomfortable for a very long time in your cramped, tiny, dank space, and getting to the point where you absolutely cannot continue anymore because you have more work and you have to start turning down work. And that's the time I chose to kind of scale up.
Going back a little bit, you fall in love with woodworking. Like, how does that, and it became addicting? You just kind of like, I want to, what's the next project? Are you always like a hands-on person?
Yeah, like what the hell? I always been, you know, I think let's call it like Michigan handy, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, grew up kind of on a farm more or less, and working with tools to some degree, machinery to some degree. You could probably put me in the box of being the type of person that like enjoys mowing the lawn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or like doing some basic kind of tools stuff or manual labor type stuff. I do enjoy those things. So that was part of it. And I think the thing that I do, I would probably say is closer to the fine woodworking, just because it's a lot of traditional joinery or, you know, handmade stuff. You get to, yes, do a manual labor thing and kind of, you know, work your frustrations out in the world and your project or whatever.
Right.
But it's also very artistic. It's also, you you have a complete blank slate for to in my case start with a tree, a log that comes down, gets delivered to me, then I saw it into slabs or whatever, and then I turn it into something. So I literally get to see it from being a tree into a table or whatever it is. And for me, it's very satisfying because you think, okay, that was just an idea I had. There's no playbook here. I'm not following anybody else's design. I'm just kind of going with what I think is cool. And wait a second, other people think it's cool?
Right.
Yeah. I think you're right. That is addicting. I hate to say it, but I'm always surprised. Like when I make something and then somebody wants to buy it, I'm always surprised. not because I think I suck or anything, but because it's just like, wow, like who the hell am I? You know?
Right. Right.
And I don't think I'm necessarily any better than like hundreds of other woodworkers or artists or crafters of any kind. But I think people see a thing that speaks to them in maybe a similar way that it spoke to you. And that's, I think, maybe part of the interesting thing, too, is finding a person whose taste or, you know, style mm-hmm. kind of matches yours. And it's kind of like a connection to a person almost.
Right.
Like if we are delivering a piece, it's hard for me to just like deliver a thing or ship a thing and not have any contact with the customer, which does happen. Some people just don't care. They just want to pay you and drop it off. See you later.
Right.
But that's really weird for me. I almost want to get to know the people and like,
yeah.
Hey, so who are you? What's your deal? Why do you want my stuff? Why did you think this was cool? And not to scratch my own back, but more to think like, hey, maybe we're the same kind of person. Maybe we could be friends.
Right. I realize you go from having a shop in a basement to a like an actual shop space. Mm-hmm. When can you make that decision of being like, I want to use reclaimed wood or sustainable sources? And why does that matter to you?
Right. I think there's a few wings to that answer. You know, I think one being I'm the type of person, I don't like waste. I recycle, you know, mm-hmm. I try to, you know, the 3 R's. I'm a big fan. The other part is when you're starting out, the cheaper the stuff, the material, the more appealing it is for sure. Like when you don't have any money and right. You can't just run to Home Depot and spend $200 on lumber or Lowe's or wherever. And you don't know where else to buy it. That's another big thing is like, if you would have asked me 5 years ago, like, oh, where do I buy a live edge slab? I'm like, what is A? What is that? B, I have no idea. Right. Like, I don't even know where to ask. And I think that was appealing to me. But from both of those angles, yeah, I think realistically the first reason is because I would go to lumber yards and sawmills, and I would just, they usually have like junk piles, scrap piles, mm-hmm. and it's literally like garbage to them. They're like, it's free, it's a dumpster, it's a burn pit, whatever, take it. And some of it's like gold. I mean, some of it's great, but it's like not perfect. You know, they can't really sell it to the top grade market or whatever. So they just don't even bother. Mm-hmm. And so I would just go scamming lumber yards and dumpster diving for the first couple of years. And then, now when I got my own space, I think the thing that really started scratching that itch is, you know, when you start looking at the bigger problem of like, you know, I don't know, our impact as humans on the planet, mm-hmm. and we create tons and tons and tons and tons of stuff, and it still kind of blows my mind that when we're done with our stuff we just bury it in the ground.
Right.
It's like, this is, how have we not figured out a better plan? Doesn't that seem kind of like prehistoric? Like, oh, we're done with this thing, what do we do with it? I don't know, just dig a hole and put it in there. Right. Like, that's the best we got?
Yeah. You know? Such a bad idea. It doesn't make
it's such an awful idea.
I just don't want to see it.
Happen? We're just going to end up with giant hills everywhere of trash, which is what we have.
Yes.
And then you start thinking, like, wait a second. We're going to cut down trees because people just don't want them in their yards, or a windstorm blew them down. And we're just going to bury those too?
They're going to the waste stream, right? It's not always turned into mulch and reused in some way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different people that, I mean, but there's so many. I mean, like most like sawmills or arborists will have some outlets of of people they like sell the logs to or whatever. A lot of it is firewood if you can process it. But the clear majority goes into a wood chipper, which then the wood chips get piled in. Like maybe you've gone along a highway and seen like a giant, you know, looks like a garbage dump, but it's wood chips. I mean, like stories high of piles of wood chips. And a lot of it gets sold to like whatever, playgrounds or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But there's way more than they'll ever be able to use. So it just sits there and rots. And some of it they'll turn into like landscaping mulch or whatever, but the majority of it sits there and rots. And so, especially when you start talking about like, I've seen, you know, 40 inch logs go into a wood chipper, which is nuts. You know,
it takes a long time to get that big.
Yeah, exactly. Like that tree had to work really hard. It was like, you know, hundreds of years old, maybe.
Oh my God.
And we're just going to put it into a wood chipper and let it rot. So, I mean, it's partially like the waste thing that, you know, and also like the potential is huge. You know, the opportunity there is great. And I think stories, everybody loves stories. Mm-hmm. And I think if you can give people a part of the story, I mean, people especially like, oh, this tree has to come down in our yard. Can you just come and get it? And I'll say, yeah, great. Why don't I make you a table out of that tree? You know?
Yeah.
And people dig that for sure. And most of the work that I get is for people that have a personal connection to Michigan, because that's where I live. And all the wood that I use is from, you know, right now in Grand Rapids where I live. And so people maybe have lived here before or they went to college here. And so they want to have a piece of that. Plus, I think they like that it's keeping things out of the waste stream and everything. But it's that story, you know, like, oh, that tree came from my grandpa's house and now I have an end table. So I'll always remember my grandparents or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
It's a beautiful thing.
That personal connection. It's just like if you could buy any table in the world or you could have one made out of the tree in your backyard at your mm-hmm. grandpa's house. Like it's the choice is easy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it does take a lot of work. And I think that's the reason most of it ends up in the wood chippers, because it takes a lot of work and a lot of time, a lot of expense to turn a log into slabs or dimensional lumber.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's, I mean, in our generation of like wanting convenience, it's a lot easier to go to a Lowe's or a Home Depot or a place. Not that you can really get super high quality stuff at either one of those locations, but you know, it's easier just to go and buy it. And I have done that before for some one-off thing that like somebody needs that you can't, you know, and that's the other part of using reclaimed lumber. It's not like I have everything on demand. I have what I have.
Right.
So I'll do that from time to time, go to a big box store or whatever. But at this point I'm connected to enough other sawmills and lumber, you know, hardwood wholesalers or whatever that I can pretty much call and get whatever I need at a moment's notice. But there's a ton of expense that goes into all that stuff. Recently, I've been collecting logs for the past 2 years here in the city of Grand Rapids from arborists. And because I have partnerships with a couple guys who know that if they just take it to the dump, they have to pay for it to be disposed of just to go into the landfill. Mm-hmm. So they'd rather support somebody like me. So I'll collect logs for a couple of years and then I hire a sawmill, a mobile mill to come to me and we mill up the logs. I let them dry for a couple of years outside, take them to the kiln, and then they're ready to be turned into furniture. So realistically, for all the stuff that I'm using, from the time that I get a log to the time that it's able to be turned into something, it's a couple of years. And when you think about, like, most people are surprised that maybe the cost of custom furniture or, you know, the time it takes to do different things. And then once you tell them that, they're like, oh, damn.
Like people True. Need that information, I think. And especially yeah, you want to be an aware consumer, you know, in general, but.
Yeah. You want to be not a total dick.
Yeah. It adds so much value, inherent value to the product itself. And yeah, don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
What, if anything, makes Michigan wood special?
You know, I think that just like the rest of Michigan, to most degrees, the thing that makes it special is the fact that it's not that special.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think, well, of course, like Michigan is awesome. I think it, you know, it comes to the Great Lakes and all that stuff. It's great. But all the wood that I work with is primarily just like really basic stuff, you know, maple. Like everybody's has probably grown up with one, if not all, of the trees that I have in my shop right now in their backyard, mm-hmm. you know, silver maple, hard maple, walnut, red oak, some cedar. I mean, those are the, you know, cherry. Those are the clear majority of stuff that I work with. And I, when I think about like, why do people like, what's so special about what I do, aside from the fact that I think I'm awesome, is the fact that it's making something that is pretty basic into something that is, you know, will last generations, but also, I mean, I don't know, nothing against, you know, like rare Brazilian blah, blah, blah hardwoods or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's kind of like, well, great. We, you know, it's kind of like the argument of people going to other countries to save or to help people in need. It's kind of like, well, there's plenty of people in need here.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I a similar argument. Like, you know, why would you go overseas on boats and planes and trains and freight or whatever's to get some super whatever piece of wood when you can find equally awesome stuff in your backyard? In fact, the product that I am selling now that people love the most and I keep getting more requests for is silver maple cookie coffee tables with just a ton of spalting. I mean, it's like black veins all over the place. And this tree was planted by my great grandfather up north in like the early 20s, I guess.
Wow.
And it's silver maple, so they grow pretty fast. So it's, I don't know, like a 36-inch diameter tree. Well, it was planted in his front yard, and his, you know, my grandpa grew up there. My dad now lives there. And the tree, the road got widened over time, and the tree eventually came down. And, you know, everybody in the neighborhood just started coming by and cutting it up for firewood. Cause that's what you do up there, you know, like it's fuel primarily, and that's okay. Cause it is getting used, but like I was the last one to get there and there was only stumps left. So like everybody back, this is mine, you know? Right. So I slabbed the stumps into cookies, like 2-3 inch cookies. And they have taken a lot of work just shoring them up with mechanical fixes, like little, bow tie joints and adding some penetrating epoxy and different things. But once they're done and they're kind of hardened again, and cause they're mostly, you know, kind of pretty close to rotten. Mm-hmm. But now once you put all that time and effort back in them, you know, people's minds are blown at how beautiful they are. And that's kind of maybe my specialty. And what I think about when I think about why is Michigan wood special is because there's tons of stuff here that is basic, but if you put some time into it, put some work into it, you can still blow up some minds just as much as if you had the most rare stuff from across the globe.
And spalting is when, like, that's rot, right? That you can sort of freeze in time with, like,
yeah, basically stuff? When a tree starts to die, I mean, some botanist is going to correct me on this, but basically when a tree starts to die, it takes on like a fungus, and bacteria grows, fungus grows, and it, I think, has to do with, you know, moisture in the tree. Because you can continue to get spalting if a tree is like on the ground or left out in the, even if it's not alive, it's just rot, basically. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, a tree starts to rot. And if you've like walked over a tree on the forest floor, there's, you know, some of the most interesting grain is in there, I'm sure. But, you know, if you can find it as it's already spalted, but it hasn't completely rotted just yet, that's kind of a relatively short window. And what will happen is if you wait too long, it just becomes crumbly wood. It's absolutely my favorite type of wood to work with is spalted maple, because it's relatively strong if you get it at the right time. And it's not going to look like any other piece you've ever seen.
What was that learning curve for you of like knowing the different types of wood and like the hard versus soft and like what's good for what type of end product?
Yeah, great question. I mean, keep in mind all these things that we're talking about like I am only recently just having like getting a handle on after doing this for about 4 years. I had no idea that like different types of woods were good for different types of things and bad for other types of things.
Right.
You know, like a pine or a, you know, softer wood, you know, wouldn't be good for structural work unless it's thicker or old growth or whatever. And why different woods had different prices and they were just like way all over the map. But I think the only way I figured it out was just trial and error, man. I mean, making a lot of mistakes. I have made so many mistakes, at least as many mistakes as successes. Absolutely. Probably way more.
And you, and sort of the old saying, but did you learn the most from those mistakes?
Yeah, of course. I mean, keep in mind, I have never taken like a class on this stuff. No one has ever shown me aside from YouTube videos, but like I have no education in this. And so everything that I make, it's the first time I've ever made it, right? Wow. There's never been a time when like, oh, Bill, let me show you how to make a table or a, you know, whatever. Do this, make this cut like this. This is how we're going to prepare for the next joint by doing this. And so like at some point you just kind of start, right? Mm-hmm. And then you just kind of struggle through it and it takes you 15 times longer than it should. And it turns out like crap, but you did it, right? Right. And it's done. And yeah, that one's definitely not for sale. It's probably going to sit in your house because it's awful, right? Yeah. Of all the connections that I've made, of all the woodworkers that I know, they're exactly like me. Like they're not licensed builders. They're not people who had a plan.
Yeah.
You know, they had like some extra space in the garage and a little extra time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, the desire came from like getting home at the end of the day of my like corporate job and like my brains were fried. Right.
Yeah.
So I needed to do something that wasn't just like lying on the couch and staring at the ceiling, you know, and like waiting for my brain to recharge because it was all just like mentally exhausting. And not that the job was even that hard, but it just it was hard for me because I guess I didn't want to do it. Right. So it started as like a decompression thing. Like it's creative. I can use my hands. I can use some tools. I use a different part of my brain. And all the really great woodworkers I knew started woodworking because something else ended. And it was like a coping mechanism. Being sick of doing something else that didn't bring you any good vibes. And then if you start doing this thing really just for you. And then before you know it, you're doing it for other people and you still don't know why, but you just keep showing up, you know?
You have another business and you do a couple other things.
Right. My other projects are pretty hands-off at this point to where if my laptop isn't too far away, I can kind of keep managing those. So I just bring it with me to my shop every day, but I wake up every day, basically 7 days a week and come to my shop and I have a mini fridge and a coffee maker here. And like, I've thought about just putting a bed in here because why not?
Right.
You know, this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm basically 24/7, either on my laptop or on my phone, kind of trying to drive this business forward, which is a very tiny business. And so when you start thinking about the grand scale of like the worldwide marketplace, it's like, who the hell am I? You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, it supports itself. It's a tiny little, you know, profitable shop that, and that's another part of it is I kind of like that it's small and I don't know if I ever want to get to the point of growing to like hire another person.
Right.
Because I've done that before and before long, your passion turns into like just more work that you kind of dread.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think keeping it small is maybe the right move for me, but, yeah, I spend, and I also like am different from a lot of people. I'm not married and I don't have kids.
Right.
Bill has time, you know, like I have a dog. That is my only obligation. So she comes to the shop with me and there's a yard out back. We play take a lot of Frisbee breaks and But sometimes I'll be in here 14 hours a day and not really realize it, you know?
Dude, that means that's so great. That means you're doing what you love.
Yeah, it's great. Somebody else said that to me recently and told me that I cracked the code. I was like, yeah, you're kind of right.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's a different code for a lot of people. Like, I think for a lot of people, it's like, man, they got to make that money. And if they're not making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, they don't know what to do with themselves. Like, I am not burdened with that.
Yeah.
You know, if I am paying all my bills and saving a little bit for the future and I'm happy while I'm doing it, like, I'm good, you know?
Yes. So what is the importance of having a shop dog?
Oh my God. Huge. In fact, if you don't have a shop dog, you're not doing it.
That's right.
Next question. No, you know, my shop dog, good story. My shop dog was my Rebound. Ended a relationship, was in a rough way, and along came Rudy. And she's kind of my sidekick. She goes everywhere with me. And she doesn't love the loud noises.
Right.
She gets pretty, she's got a little dog house in my shop that she goes and hides in. like I said, we play do a lot of Frisbee breaks. She chews on a lot of sticks. She's got some jobs. She's pulling her weight.
Good.
But, it's whenever I go to visit other people at their shops, you know, or like on Instagram or whatever, you see other people and they have shop dogs.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, they know what's up.
Yeah. That's like, oh, they've reached the level where, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's like pro status.
Well, thanks so much, man. Appreciate, you getting on the phone and everything. This is great.
Yeah, no problem, man. Happy to do it.
Hey, that's all we have for you today. Thanks for listening. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen so you don't miss a thing. Remember to follow us on Instagram and feel free to email me with any comments or questions. You can reach me personally at alec@woodencompany.com. No E. Thanks.